Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today with Jamie Marisotis, who is the president and chief executive officer of the Lumina Foundation. He's written a new book called America Needs Talent, Attracting, Educating, and Deploying the 21st Century Workforce that we're going to be discussing. If you'd like to join that conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Jamie, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
It's good to have you here. Your book is not a modest one. I'll say, having read that, you've got, by my count, recommendations for revamping, reorganize, in some ways revolutionizing the higher education system, for in some ways completely upending the immigration debate,
right?
And redefining the relationships between government and the various private, for-profit and not-for-profit sectors. So I'm going to start the conversation by asking, you know, running one of the leading philanthropic organizations in the country wasn't enough for you. You had to take on all of that other stuff too.
Well, you know, part of the reason that I wrote the book was this idea that there's a relationship between prosperity, in other words, our prosperity as Americans, and these issues about talent. You know, talent is really something very specific in my view, which is, you know, we tend to think of talent as like, you know, the TV show America's Got Talent.
Singing and dancing.
Right. You know, we talk about talent in ways that what we really mean when we use the word talent in the sort of colloquial sense is skill, that you have a specific focused ability or skill to do something. But to me, talent is really something that is so tied to our success, to our flourishing as an American society, that I decided to write a book that was really about the big ideas about why talent is so important in terms of the 21st century in America, and also my ideas about how we get there. I recognize that not all of these ideas will be implemented now or maybe ever, but the focus is really to try to get a conversation going about how we get to where we need to be as a country, which is not incremental. It's about large-scale change.
And we'll start. I mean, you've got basically five areas you break it down into, five ideas. We'll start, and I should say, obviously, we're going to be talking about higher ed. Anyone who knows what I do for a living, I probably ought to do a disclosure. I can't pretend to be a completely disinterested observer in that discussion
Get
it out there. But you talk about really approaching the way we, and I'm trying to look for the right verb, deliver, I guess, is not the right one, but it's as close as I can get to, higher education and prepare people for meaningful lives. Particularly, you say that, you know, the way we account for college, the credit hour system and all of that isn't getting us close to where we want to go. What do you propose instead?
Well, you know, my diagnosis and my prescription, I think, are highly aligned here. My diagnosis about the problem with talent in America is highly related to what I think higher education needs to do a lot more of. So you think about, well, you know, what are the big problems that we have to deal with in terms of talent in American society? One of them is that we have a lot of unfilled jobs in American society right now that are unfilled because of a lack of talent. And that lack of talent is primarily in jobs where a post-secondary education, that means a certificate, a degree, an associate degree, a bachelor's degree, some form of post-secondary learning is required. In fact, two-thirds of the jobs being created in this decade will require post-secondary education. And the problem for the higher education system, and I want to be clear here that one of the arguments I make in the book is that when we say the higher education system, what we mean is the colleges and universities. To me, the higher education system should be the students. The students are the sort of core of the system. And there are a bunch of providers of post-secondary learning, of which colleges and universities are pretty important, but they're not the only post-secondary providers anymore. In other words, we tend to think of the way you prepare people for work and for life, which colleges and universities clearly do, as being something that can happen in the military. It can happen in your job. It can happen in other ways. But college and universities are the primary producers of this talent that we need to power our economy and strengthen our democracy. But higher education in that sense, the colleges and universities now, are really not well prepared to deal with that. They have several problems that they've got to confront that deal with their capacity. One of them is that they're increasingly unaffordable for a large number of Americans. We all know the price problem that we have in American higher education. Tuitions have increased on average in American higher education, college and universities, at more than twice the rate of inflation for more than three decades. This is a long-term systemic issue that we have. We also have challenges, I think, in our higher education system with the fact that we aren't serving enough people. We literally have a greater demand than we have the capacity to meet because of the way the system is structured. And there are questions about what we produce in higher education. In other words, what kind of talent are we producing? What's the knowledge, the skills, the abilities that people actually have? And can we tell? If you have a bachelor's degree, what does that really represent? What do you know? What can you do with that bachelor's degree? And so part of what I try to get at in the book here is to match that diagnosis with the solutions. And the solutions have to do with really rethinking the entire system, putting the students at the center, as you point out, upending the system of credit hours, which is, ironically, you know, it's a system, you probably know this because you're in the field, that was originally designed to actually figure out how you allocate pensions. That was the original purpose of the credit hour. But it has become, I call it the deus ex machina. It's the thing that solves every problem in higher education. Everything runs through the credit hour.
Or the third rail is
the
another
third
way
rail,
to refer
right.
To
I
it
mean, it's,
too.
We compensate faculty, we determine tuition rates, everything runs through the idea of the credit hour. The problem with the credit hour is that it's a time-based unit. The credit hour is largely a unit based on the amount of time you spend in the class or in the lab, and it really is not highly connected to the learning. And I don't mean in any way to impugn what happens in our colleges and universities. We just don't know. We just don't know what the learning is that's behind those credit hours. Our accreditation system is under fire by policymakers and others for lots of reasons. And I think my proposal is to actually think more about what does a degree represent or what does any post-secondary credential represent in terms of learning, in terms of the knowledge, skills, and abilities that people should have. And we describe that in various terms. I like the word competency. Some people like the word proficiency. I don't care what we call it. The idea would be that if you have a bachelor's degree or an associate degree or a master's degree, it should represent real and relevant learning. And you should be able to say a bachelor's degree represents this level of learning, and you can articulate it. And then the student should go through the academic program knowing what they are already proficient or competent at and then what the post-secondary learning system is going to provide to them so that they can actually be successful. And, you know, one of the criticisms I think people have of this model is that they fear that it aims people in higher education simply towards career or job outcomes. My view is that we've talked past each other on this point in our education debate because, in fact, most of what we say we do in higher education, and I think this is true, which is produce people who are critical thinkers and problem solvers and communicators, people who can actually be adaptive in terms of how they approach their work and their life. Those are the same things that the employers say that they need. What they value most is people that have those broad, generalizable knowledge, skills, and abilities. And so we've got to figure out how to better align that and turn the system on its head. If we turn the system on its head so that the constant in the system is learning and time is the variable as compared to the current system where time is the constant and learning is the variable, I think we would have some very dramatic effects. We would be able to bring down the price. We'd actually be able to be clearer about what the degrees mean, and we'd have a better sense about what we're producing in terms of the high-quality learning that American society needs from our colleges and universities.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with the Lumina Foundation's leader, Jamie Marisotis, about his new book, America Needs Talent. We're talking right now about the ways he's suggesting we should reform higher education. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So we'll walk through how this would look if we did it. If we dispensed with the credit hour, presumably, and I guess what I'll say is I read your book, and I have read it, and I would recommend it to our listeners. It is a provocative look at how we reinvigorate not just higher ed, but many of sort of the paralyzed discussions in our country right now, in our culture. But if we dispense with the credit hour, as you point out in your book, one of, you know, in the current system, sort of the guarantee is considered the quality of the institution. At some level, if you go to Harvard, that means something, right, as opposed to, you know, another school that.
Right.
And in this case, we would be looking at setting proficiencies or competencies. I thought, okay, in political terms, you're marching yourself into Common Core territory there, too, where people are going to be balking at what the standard should be. And in some ways, would that also be breaking down those institutions? Because I thought, okay, you know, in my field, for example, Indiana University has got one of the best feature writers on the planet, Tom French, in their journalism program. We do state government reporting better than anybody in the state. Ball State does a lot of electronic stuff. In theory, I think where you're going is that if you wanted to go into the communications field, to some degree, you ought to be able to sample from those three institutions, right?
Right. Well, I think let's be clear here. We have an issue in education in general in terms of the difference between K-12 and higher education. There's an important difference, which is that K-12 is mandatory and higher education is not, though mm-hmm. I would argue that higher education is increasingly a prerequisite. In other words, you won't make it into the middle class unless you get a higher education. It is not legally mandated. And there's a big difference between the two. That's where I think the differences among institutions, among colleges and universities, is really important. In our K-12 schools, we want to make sure that our schools are providing a common level of knowledge, skills, and abilities as much as possible, so that we can actually get students to that starting line, which is what a high school credential really represents. It's the starting line, not the finish line, for the vast majority of jobs in this country. The second point, and I think this is really the critical one here, is that in higher education, we need to be extremely clear about the fact that when we say that someone has the credential, that the credential, whether it's a degree or something else, actually represents something that they can take into the marketplace, into work, into their life experience, et cetera. And there really is no common understanding of what that credential means today. And so what we do is we use reputation as the proxy. So we say, ah, Harvard's good. Why is it good? Well, because people say it's good for the most part, because we don't have very clear
and
expectations.
Because you have to spend $350,000.
Well, that's right. So yeah. So the market is suggesting that there's a premium that's paid for it. But I would argue that, and I make this point in the book, it's much like saying, ah, John went to the Cleveland Clinic, so we know he's healthy. Yeah. Well, actually, no, we don't. We have objective indicators of knowing whether or not John is healthy. And we know that because we can use objective health data. My point simply is that let's develop some sort of understanding about what these degrees actually mean, and then allow the institutions to compete. Let the market actually work so that Ball State can prove that it's better at X than IU is at Y or what have you. And right now, what we have is reputation as the proxy. We use reputation as a sort of self-perpetuating model. The Ivy League is apparently always the Ivy League. I'm not sure why that is, or why we should always accept that certain schools were always a good and therefore are always going to be good. What we need is differentiation, because the point is the system needs people coming out of our colleges and universities to actually have real and relevant learning that's going to matter. To me, that's what American society needs.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with the president and CEO of the Lumina Foundation, Jamie Mirosotis, about his new book, America Needs Talent, Attracting, Educating, and Deploying the 21st Century Workforce. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. That's a toll-free call. You also can reach us via email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Jamie Marisotis. He is in the largest part of his life, the president and chief executive officer of the Lumina Foundation, but he also is an author who's written a new book, America Needs Talent, Attracting, Educating, and Deploying the 21st Century Workforce. And in the book, you offer sweeping suggestions. We've already been talking about the higher ed challenges and all of that. And we probably could spend the rest of the hour talking about that subject alone, but that would not do service to your book or the recommendations you offer. The other area that you talk about is really attempting to change the nature of the dialogue we're having as a nation about immigration. I probably could set it. Could you talk a little bit about what changes you would like to see in the way we approach immigration?
Well, let's start with maybe a statement of the obvious, which is that this is the third rail of American politics right now. This is an extremely challenging time for us to be talking about immigration for lots of good reasons. I think that our concerns about border security and terrorism are legitimate and important, and we need to pay attention to those things. My view, however, is that if that's all we talk about when we talk about immigration, we are missing what is the bigger point. And the bigger point is that we are a nation of immigrants and that our success as a country has been driven by the promise of America and the fact that as a country, we welcomed immigrants, we allowed people to be more successful by coming here and building a life, as my family did, immigrating from Greece a generation ago, and as millions of other families have done from many different countries around the world. My view of immigration is that what we need to be talking about is what is being called now a comprehensive approach to immigration, which is that we've actually got to focus on addressing the totality of our immigration needs. So from the perspective of what we need in terms of our prosperity, let's recognize that immigrants at the low end of the talent pipeline, the middle end, and the high end all contribute to our prosperity. We know this in terms of objective economic indicators. We know this through things like the proportion of people who are immigrants that are entrepreneurs and new business creators. We know this from the perspective of the ways in which immigrants have impacted our cultural well-being as a country. But again, these are complex, difficult issues. What I try to do in the book is actually pivot the conversation to say, let's talk about what we need from our immigration system rather than simply the problems. Let's deal with the problems, but let's also talk about what we need. And what we need is talent, talent at all ends of the continuum. As I said, the low, the middle, and the high ends. And we have some good examples from other countries that have actually done this, that have actually addressed these issues, most prominently Australia and Canada. And in the book, I talk extensively about the Australian model because they spent a lot of time building the model. And the Australians will tell you immediately that it is not a perfect model. But what they essentially do is articulate what their skill needs are as a society. And then they use their immigration strategies to actually recruit people, for lack of a better term, at those low, middle, and high ends. So that model where they apply points based on work experience, based on education level, et cetera, seems to work really well. In the United States, we've got to certainly do that, but we've also got to deal with what I think is the even more pressing and complicated challenge, which is what are we going to do with the 10 to 11 million people who are here, who are undocumented, for whom they have no legal status? And, of course, we know that there have been efforts that have gone back to 2007 with the efforts under President Bush and now more recently in just the last Congress, and we have not gotten very far because of the emotionalism and the real issues. And we're seeing it very recently now because of what's happened in Paris about the risks that are inherent in an immigration strategy. My bottom line, I think, is that if our immigration strategy is based solely on fear, we will get what we will out of the system, which is more fear and more anxiety. But if it's based on hope, if it's based on this idea that immigrants are going to add value to our society, and we've got to figure out the right way to bring people here and incorporate them into our society. I think as we did in the 20th century, we will really benefit from that. And I'm an optimist by nature. I think that we've seen in other cases the American public come around on certain issues that are important and pressing from a social perspective. And I'm hopeful that by pivoting to a different kind of conversation in immigration, we'll actually get to a more reasonable point.
Well, and I thought that was one of the most provocative things in your book, because you really I realize I'm risking oversimplifying your argument here, but I thought you are once again turning that discussion on its head. You're really saying instead of making the focus of our immigration debate on the folks that we want to keep out of the country, it should be on attracting the folks we want to have come in, the ones who will bring things to a skill sets and other virtues that we might need. If you are just joining us, we are talking with Jamie Marisotis, who is the leader of the Lumina Foundation and has written a new book called America Needs Talent. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what another listener named Jamie has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I just found it very interesting. I find this to be very true in my field. I'm in early childhood education, birth to 5 years, and I also run a children's ministry. And in my community, although I don't have a degree, I've just, street smart, cool hard knocks, just being gifted with children, I believe that I know more than several other people in the field that come from college backgrounds with degrees. And it's just something I see increasingly, and it's very frustrating to me that, I don't qualify for this or I don't qualify for that because I don't have a degree. Yet I feel like I have more job knowledge and more knowledge of children than people out there who do have a degree.
Well, thanks very much for the call and the comment. The other Jamie, the one here in the studio who wrote the book, was nodding his head while you were talking. I'm going to give him a chance to respond. Thank you again for the call.
Well, I think the Jamies are in agreement in the sense that I think that we should be recognizing the talent that you have. I think what we need to figure out, though, is how we can actually get you into some sort of system where that talent gets recognized. In other words, in education, we actually have this growing movement called assessment of prior learning. It's a sort of awkward phrase, but it essentially means that you can assess what you know based on your work experience, based on prior educational experience, et cetera, and actually get recognized for that, get credit, get some sort of recognition for it that would put you on the path or put you even very close to an actual credential. The credential really, though, is your calling card, as you point out, in the labor market, that employers need to recognize that you have a degree or some other credential as a sort of prerequisite for the jobs that are available. And so I think it's a really valuable point. I think we should recognize that. And I also think that your point about the fact that you may know a lot more than people with college degrees should be a wake-up call to our colleges and universities that they need to do a better job than what they're doing right now in actually preparing people who have those knowledge, skills, and abilities that we can recognize and understand that there's real and relevant learning behind their degrees so that they can actually be competitive in those labor markets.
And there is a sense of urgency in your book, too. And when we were in the break, you and I were talking about the fact that, by the year 2030, economists are predicting that we're going to face a worldwide labor shortage. And in some ways, the competition for skilled labor around the world, among countries, developed countries in particular, is going to be intense. Part of the sense I got from your book is we're not ready to meet that challenge right now.
It is my biggest concern, I think, in the couple of months since my book has been out, and I've been traveling around the country on my book tour and meeting with people and doing interviews like this. And I think there's a lot of recognition about the nature of the problem. In other words, that we do, in fact, have a shortage of talent, and talent that we can recognize, talent that we can develop and deploy. But that sense of urgency just doesn't seem to be there. And I think there are big threats. The threats that you can see in terms of what other countries are doing, where they have invested in a very concerted way, in a very organized way to actually compete with the United States. And so, you know, in the level of post-secondary educational attainment, people with associate degrees or higher, the United States was the tops in the world for many decades. We're now, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between 10th and 12th in terms of the proportion of 25 to 34-year-olds with college degrees. That should be a big wake-up call. It should also be a big wake-up call when you talk to global employers and they talk about where they're getting their top talent, and they are saying on a declining basis that the United States is the number one place to get that talent. So I think there are real threats. And one of the things that the United States did well in the past that we no longer have the benefit of is use our size as an advantage. In other words, we had more talent than other countries. But when countries like India and China are producing talent at the rates that they're producing it, it's not that their proportion of their citizens will have the level of talent that we will have in the United States. It'll take them a fairly long time to get there, but they literally will have more people with the kind of talent that you need in the 21st century economy, and that will put very significant stress, very significant pressure on the American economy. And that talent shortage is coming. The World Bank, as you said, points out that by 2030 there's going to be a very significant talent shortage, and I just don't think that we are prepared. I don't think that we recognize the urgency of that challenge in our country.
We're talking about securing talent for the United States, revitalizing both our economy and our culture. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly.
I wanted to make a couple of quick comments. One, I think we have to deal with the reality that we don't quite have the job shortage in the STEM area, science, technology, engineering, and math, that we often say. There have been studies that rebut this, and it's borne out by the fact that people with that kind of training are not able to find the jobs that are supposed to be there. The other thing I wanted to comment on was the effect of online job applications and perhaps weeding out people that could be qualified for unfilled jobs and are not given the opportunity. And I think the interest often with business in the United States is in bringing in people under the H-1B visas, rather to keep competitive wages down rather than seeking to match qualified people with the jobs. And I'd like to hear comments about those. Thanks
very much for the call and the questions, Greg.
So STEM, and I think many of the listeners recognize that science, technology, engineering, and mathematics is a very complex space. I think you make a very good point, which is that we actually know less than we probably think we do about the nature of the STEM jobs and the demand for STEM jobs in the American economy in the near and intermediate term. One of the reasons why we got into this debate about STEM in the United States was that we looked at these international comparisons, again, between particularly what our European and Asian colleagues have been doing around the world compared to what we were doing, and we saw that we were far behind in terms of these performance indicators, in terms of schooling, knowledge, et cetera. But the labor market in the United States is different than most other labor markets. And I think this is part of the point that you're making, which is we have a much more sophisticated, complex labor market. And it's not that educating people in the STEM fields has a direct path to jobs in those STEM fields in a way that it would be in maybe some other countries. And that sort of complicates the conversation. The other issue, this may not be a popular point with some of your listeners, but I have a view here that part of what we may have misunderstood from the data about wages is that we've come to recognize that for some jobs, you make a lot of money early in your career. So engineering being a very good example, that if you look at the wage data on engineers, recent graduates with engineering credentials do extremely well. But over time, other fields do catch up. And I don't think we've done a very good job in recognizing that in terms of the longer-term wage growth, nor do we fully understand why in certain fields people end up in careers that don't appear to be a straight line to the job. So the best example that that I hear from economists all the time is that there's actually an overrepresentation of people with English degrees, which are getting a lot of maligning in our national conversation in the last decade or so, in the financial services industry. And I think that's sort of counterintuitive. You'd think, well, weren't they all business and economics and finance majors? And the answer is no. And one of the reasons, I think, is that there's a huge customer service element to the people communication skills in the financial services industry. And those people are highly valued. So we don't have the linear path that other countries do into the labor market. And I think that complicates our conversations.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener. And if you'd like to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. It says, what would happen if employers stopped requiring degrees and instead required skill sets?
You know, in a way, I think that's the model that we're moving towards. And you can see that's part of the reason why I'm urging American higher education to actually make sure that what the degree means can be articulated, can be described, that those competencies and proficiencies can be articulated. Employers are getting more sophisticated. They are getting clearer about what their expectations are. A degree or other credential is really a proxy. And employers still overwhelmingly use those proxies, but they're also expressing increasing dissatisfaction with the proxy. It doesn't give them everything that they need, and so they want a better understanding about what those degrees and other credentials represent. So, you know, I think that day is coming if you look at the very sophisticated approaches of technology companies like LinkedIn and how they're able to essentially crowdsource the skill or knowledge level of people who are on LinkedIn. You can see a path in the not-too-distant future where, in fact, employers can get a better understanding of what those skills and knowledge are by essentially having some sort of digital passport that people might possess that would show, here's what I have in terms of education, here's what I have in terms of work experience, and here's what I have in terms of skills and knowledge that I can demonstrate and that others would validate. In other words, that others would say, yes, I know that John actually can do those things because I've worked with him, I've studied with him, I've done those kinds of things. And that may actually have higher value from an employer perspective over time. Technology really is going to revolutionize this. LinkedIn is not no longer an online resume service. It has really become a very sophisticated tool. And I think those types of tools are going to become increasingly important in informing employers about the knowledge, skills, and abilities that prospective employees bring.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Lumina Foundation leader Jamie Marisotis about his new book, America Needs Talent, Attracting, Educating, and Deploying the 21st Century Workforce. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with Jamie Marisotis, who is the president and chief executive officer of the Lumina Foundation. He's written a new book called America Needs Talent, Attracting, Educating, and Deploying the 21st Century Workforce. In it, he offers a series of sweeping suggestions about the way we might restructure some of our most important conversations about immigration, about higher education, about the role of cities, and about the relationships between government and the private sector. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Don has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Jamie, really enjoying your nuanced unpacking of these issues like the English majors or the immigrants. I really appreciate the work that you're doing with Lumina. I have a question for you regarding these new sort of evidence-rich digital credentials, digital badges, and other such that many people think have promise for addressing some of the issues that you're raising here. I wonder if you, in your book or in the foundation, are thinking about those. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Dan.
Yeah, we are thinking a great deal about this. In fact, we started about a year ago at Lumina Foundation with some conversations that culminated recently, just last month, in a national dialogue on credentials that brought together business leaders, civic leaders, education leaders, workforce-based organizations from 90 different national organizations to actually have this very conversation. So what's happened is that there's been a sort of proliferation of these credentials. In other words, that you've seen these digital badges, these new types of certifications and other things that have sprung up that didn't exist before. As you point out, some of them are quite evidence-rich in terms of their content. And the question is, how do you link them? In other words, how do you actually create connections among them so that you don't end up in a bunch of cul-de-sacs and dead ends where you're accumulating a bunch of things that don't have value either to you personally or in the labor market? And then how do you actually make sure that they're stackable, that you can create connections among them so that at the end of some sort of journey that involves your work and your learning experience, you actually have some things that will be marketable for you personally? It's a complicated conversation, and I do think that the starting point has to be a greater understanding of how much of that is going on out there. And, you know, just to give you some sense of this, our national dialogue includes everybody from the Business Roundtable in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to the AFL-CIO and the AFT to the organizations representing education and workforce-based organizations at a national level. So this is a very complex, rich conversation. But in my view, we have to be talking about this. You have to credential the learning. The credential is your calling card. It's the way you demonstrate that you've got these knowledge, skills, and abilities. It's not just about degrees anymore. And finding ways to actually create these stronger connections and understanding of what's behind them is going to be extremely important.
Gotten an email from our regular listener, Jerry. Hi, Jerry. If you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry says, too often people think that just a college degree is a guarantee of a job or career. It is not. A college degree only guarantees an interview.
You know, I think that's right, which is that the college degree is a prerequisite. It's a statement of sort of minimum qualification. Hopefully it also represents some of your potential. And this is one of the issues about being clearer about what the degrees actually mean that I think is very important. But I don't think that the college degree is necessarily the thing that is going to take you from your third to your fourth or your seventh to your eighth job. I think really it's the combination of your educational and your work and your life experience that comes together that makes you successful in work and in life. And if I can, I just want to underscore this point here that a lot of the things that we talk about here, they're interchangeable, that what makes you successful in work also makes you successful in life, that those things about critical thinking and problem solving and communicating serve you just as well at home and in your civic life and in your personal experiences as it does in work. And I think we tend not to understand that those things are really interchangeable and they're important for all of us as Americans.
We are talking about the search for talent and a way to meet many of America's most pressing problems. Rod, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Jamie, I'm curious. I've spent the last 20 years in career college education. And unfortunately, over the last few years, the news of my sector is not necessarily good news. Mm. And probably rightfully so with some of the bad actors we've had. I'm curious how you see the career college industry playing a role in this transformation you speak of, because we work directly at this competency-based learning, credentialed certification, professional licensure, et cetera. Thank you for taking the call.
Certainly. Thanks very much for the call, Rod.
Well, I'm an idealist, so let me explain my ideal, and then let me talk a little bit about the reality. In my ideal view, it shouldn't matter where you learn. It should matter what you learn. And to me, that's the most important thing, because it is the knowledge, skills, and abilities that you have that ultimately is going to make you successful in work and in life. And so I'm somewhat agnostic about this question about whether it's a for-profit or a not-for-profit or a two-year or a four-year or a research university or a teaching and learning type institution. That shouldn't matter as much as what you can actually demonstrate in terms of what your degree represents. The reality, however, is that, and I recognize the reality because I've written about this over the course of three decades of my career, that, in fact, we have had abuses in the for-profit sector that we've never been able to fully resolve. And those abuses have to do with the fact that there's large amounts of money at stake and that these for-profit entities are legally mandated. They are legally required to maximize shareholder value, and that sometimes it puts them in competition, if you will, with their own objectives. Many of these places do really care about the students, but they also have trouble with reconciling that with the profit motive that's inherent. And so we've developed these complicated regulatory schemes. Many of them don't work particularly well, particularly at the federal level. And we're really not a lot further than we were when I was first writing about this in the late 80s and early 90s. What's different, though, is that this demand for talent has risen. And with the rising demand for talent, I think we've got to get more serious about holding all post-secondary education providers to a higher standard. And here, I think we've got to shine the spotlight as much on so-called traditional higher education as we do on the for-profit sector, because my view is that we should not accept unacceptably low graduation or student success rates from traditional colleges and universities any more than we should from the for-profit institutions. And, you know, one of the things I point out in the book is that there is a third path here that we haven't really done a lot of exploration with, which is so-called low-profit or benefit corporation models, where these are legal entities that are actually established where their social mission and their profit mission are equal. In other words, the maximizing shareholder value is not superior to the other values that you hold as an organization. And I'd be interested in seeing wholly new, not places that convert to B Corps, but wholly new entities that are created with this idea in mind that are focused on producing more talent. Indiana actually is one of now a majority of states that legally allows B corporations, though I think the Indiana law doesn't go into existence until next year, the application next year. It was passed by the legislature in the last session, and I think there are opportunities for Indiana to be one of those states where we could create some new B Corps that are focused on talent development and deployment, where we could actually recognize greater opportunity to produce more talent without there being the kinds of challenges that we've seen in some of these for-profit career colleges.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Clyde. If you'd like to find us on Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Clyde says, with only 27% participating in the 2014 election, how does competency-based education prepare citizens to participate in a democratic society? It's sort of the Jeffersonian argument that our investment in education is about preparing for citizenship, not necessarily vocational training.
It's a great question. And just to give you some international perspective on this, we've been talking about this issue for a number of years. Other countries have actually been talking about this much longer. And one of the things that's different about the competency-based learning conversation in the United States compared to most other countries is that this question about civic value and the civic purposes of education are much more prominent in the United States than they are in other countries. And it's just a fact. It's one of the things that does, I think, make us stand out from other nations in a lot of different ways, that we actually value democratic participation, whether it's voting or volunteering or contributing in other ways to your community and your family. And those types of things are very important. In many of the competency-based learning models, this is actually a value that's recognized. So here in Indiana, we have Western Governors University, which is an extraordinarily good institution, providing bachelor's degrees in four different career areas. But there are other competency-based learning models as well. One of them that's getting a lot of attention nationally is based in New Hampshire. Southern New Hampshire University has a relatively new competency-based learning entity called College for America. And in College for America's learning protocol, the competencies that they are articulating, this is actually deeply embedded in the model, that these civic competencies are actually a very important and prominent part of what they expect before they're going to give you that degree that has their name on it at Southern New Hampshire. And I think this model is going to grow because I do think that competency-based learning represents ultimately a superior model for our country. But we're just at the beginning of this, and it's going to take time. And making sure that those civic values are incorporated into it is going to be an important element of that.
We have got a lot of calls stacked up here. So I'm going to ask both our listeners whose calls we are going to be taking, and if I might respectfully, our guest to try to be as concise as possible in expression so we give as many people a chance as possible. Jay, welcome to the program.
Gay?
Gay, I'm sorry. They mistyped. Okay. My apologies. Gay, my apologies.
A number of years ago, a former president of Cummins Industry and I were having a conversation, and he said that frequently, that in the most part, they would prefer to hire somebody who had a liberal arts education over a person with an MBA because he felt that the MBA told the people how to think and not, I mean, what to think and not how to think, whereas a liberal arts education was more creative in how to think. And the other was when I was in school, I started out in education. And as an example only, there are several what I call tritzy courses. One was games, where we had to go to the library and look up different games for children and write down on 3x5 cards. And we had to have so many each week. And I went to a teacher's supply store in Indianapolis over a holiday and realized that they had a box that had exactly all of that in it for $25. And it angered me that I was spending my parents' tuition money on something that I could buy in a box for $25. So I just I do think there are a lot of very irrelevant courses that are being taught. That's all I had to say.
Thanks very much. Sorry for getting your name wrong. I apologize. Jamie.
You know, just quickly, I think the point about the liberal arts needs to be underscored, which is that I think a lot of the criticism of liberal arts right now is the major associated with what people are studying in the liberal arts. And so there's criticism of things like art history or things like that, because the wages aren't very high for those people. But in fact,
it's kind of hard to quantify the skill set.
Absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's challenging. But those issues about how to think versus what to think are really important. And this is what employers say in survey after survey, that they value content. They want people to know something about graphic design or chemistry or history or whatever it might be. But they really want them to have those generalizable skills that you often get in those liberal learning type institutions.
We are talking about America Needs Talent, a new book written by my guest, Jamie Marisotis. Art, welcome to the program.
Number one, in his book, Talent is Overrated, Jeff Colvin says that it's not native intelligence, talent, native ability, intellectual ability, but it's the ability to discern, observe, evaluate, and conclude that then drives a strong goal-setting process, which results in persistence, vigilance, perseverance, and a, quote, informed practice, by which he has found it means that developed the skills as needed as the person was progressing, say, in the study of violin. 3 years earlier, Professor Carol Dweck, in her book Mindset, posited that if you have a growth mindset that sees problems as obstacles and goals as things that are easy to achieve rather than impossible to achieve, that it strongly motivates children to proceed toward those goals. And nearly at the same time, Paul Tsoff, in his book, How Children Succeed, found very similar conclusions with a variety of additional factors. How do you fit those all into your picture?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Art.
Yeah, quickly, I've actually read two of those three books. And so, I think that innate ability is not enough. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming that, in fact, you've actually got to develop and cultivate the knowledge, skills, and abilities that people have in order to help them be successful. And, you know, we know that from the labor market data. We know that from lots of other surveys and studies that we've seen. In fact, I think this is one of the issues that we've got to confront as an American society, is that our assumptions about what worked for us in the 20th century, which was this combination of American grit and determination with a good basic education at the K-12 level and an elite higher education system that largely educated a leadership class, is good enough. It's not. It's not good enough, because, in fact, what we need is actually to deploy a much larger level of talent that we need in American society. And so the ability to tap the innate abilities, I have no concern about that. Gallup and other organizations have demonstrated that certain people actually have certain, they call it their skills finder approach, abilities that you can actually develop and grow. But let's be clear, you've got to actually develop and grow those talents. And the only way that you do that is through structured learning work and other environments.
I've gotten a tweet from a listener named CPA COE who says, we are working on changing learning for CPAs to a competency-based model. Can Jamie Marisotis talk about continuing education?
You know, in a sense, what we're really talking about here is not a new idea, which is the idea of learning being a lifetime prospect, that in fact the learning production cycle where you went to school up until you were the age of 22 or 24 and then you spent the rest of your life applying yourself based on the learning that you got in formalized schooling really doesn't work for us anymore. It probably hasn't worked for us for a while, but we just haven't been able to recognize that.
We're getting close here on the counter. You know, if there is an overarching theme to this, it really needs that we have to wake up to the fact that we need to attract and encourage more people to develop their skill sets.
And that's exactly right. That, you know, I think here in the 21st century, what we've got to acknowledge is that talent is what's going to make us prosperous in the 21st century. I actually developed this idea in the book that I call the Gross Talent Product, which is a sort of a combination of the market and non-market value that we actually get from talent in our country. And it's $7 trillion, and that represents more than the combined value of the GDPs of several countries. We've got to be clear about what the talent is that we need, because that's what's going to power our economy and strengthen our democracy here in the 21st century.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Jamie Marisotis. Also would like to encourage our listeners who were not able to get their questions asked to visit our Facebook page and pose them there. Maybe Jamie can jump in and answer questions there. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.